Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. How's everybody doing? We have some time. There's some background noise. If you are aware of that, would you mute star six to obviate that background noise? And be sure and do star six again when you come back to talk so that I'll be able to hear you. I'd like to hear any thoughts or reflections or questions from any of our previous two seminars, or just things that you would like to discuss that the seminars have stimulated for you. I hear some background noise. Could I get a mute star six? There's still some background noise. If I could get a mute, I can go to lecture mode, but I'd like to have a discussion at the beginning to hear any comments or questions or things that any of you would like to talk about, clarifications or anything that our previous discussion has stimulated for you. Okay, we're in presentation mode. I went to that because of the background noise that wasn't managed. So I'm going to go immediately into our seminar, and then we'll have some discussion time at the end. I want to discuss in this seminar what I believe is the primary difference between success and failure, the primary factor for massive success, and that's regulating states of mind, mastery mindset development. Athletes need to not be the only ones who perform exercises to get themselves in state before their performance, before going on to the court or field. Actors and performers and speakers do as well. Anyone who tells a story does. Getting in state is mental, emotional, physical. Getting into the optimum state of mind is vital from working with clients to the art of the tell. It's something that I believe is important each time that I receive a call from a client, that I spend a moment or two to really get centered and grounded, to be totally present in every way so that I can fully engage and be immersed in working with that client. And I want to talk some aspects of states of mind that I think are really important in terms of our practices. We know now from the science of storytelling that a story is the most powerful way to activate our brains. When we're being told a story, it activates not only the language processing areas, but also the other areas used for experiencing the events of the story. Someone tells us about how delicious a peach is. Our sensory cortex lights up. If it's about emotion, our right neocortex gets active. For example, when the story characters were grabbing object, motor neurons were active. Vision-related neurons fire when the characters were observing their environment. A story puts our whole brain to work. Stories affect us mentally as well as physically. Ann Crindle at the Dartmouth Brain Lab showed how viewers' brains resonated with the specific emotion enacted on the screen. When the central character was angry, the viewer's brains registered anger as well. When the scene was sad, the viewer's brains corresponded. Whenever we see a scene, for example, of disgust, the brain region of our disgust, the anterior insula, fires. We sense the other person's intentions and imagine what an experience means in his or her mind. Mindsight, our innate ability to see into each other's minds, relies on our mirror neurons sensing an authenticity in another person acting with conscious and active purpose. What this means is, for the art of the tell, is that the teller's state of mind and intention is key to making an audience listen. And this applies whether you're talking with someone about a potential client engagement, whether you're doing a presentation, or engaging with colleagues. For example, if we sense the other person is distracted, we automatically put up our defenses by tuning out or listen with less than 100% immersion. When somebody smiles and looks directly into our eyes, it enhances the inclination to relax and feel more trusting. Intuition is the brain knowing what the conscious mind later sees. Now, this means that getting in state needs to be before you face your audience, before you accept your call from your client. Relax your body, control your breath, get solidly grounded to access the optimum state of mind for a particular task. The primary reason to get in state is to concentrate your energy on the outcome of the story that you desire. A significant relationship competency is self-regulation and self-management, knowing your skills and knowing how to deploy them effectively. An example of what you focus on that can determine your state of mind. The great aerialist Carl Wallenda, the patriarch of the flying Wallendas, had performed death-defying feats on the high wire for more than 50 years. Still at the age of 71, Wallenda's capacity for concentration on his intention was legendary. His concentration on success had acted as a self-fulfilling prophecy for over five decades of triumph on the high wire. What you focus on grows. Wallenda's wife indicated that he had been anxious the day before taking the wire, a tightrope without a safety net, in San Juan, Puerto Rico. For the first time in all the years she'd known him, he was concentrating before the show not on succeeding, but on the risk of falling. He personally supervised the attachment of the guy wires, which he had never done before. During the performance, he tragically fell to his death. What you focus on grows. Now, I want to talk about a mastery mindset and the importance of that. People like, respect, trust, and are most likely influenced by those who have the ability to remain calm and thoughtful. This default setting to remain centered and grounded no matter what is an essential success paradigm. Regulating your own state of mind in a sustained way is the most effective influence on someone else to do the same. The two most important determinants of success are beliefs and state management. So first, let's talk about beliefs as part of the difference between success and failure. Beliefs are the most important elements to determine what we will or what we won't do. The power of belief, what we believe, is the meaning that we feel certain will come from situations. That will determine how we behave and what we do. Social neuroscientists show us that we have to believe what we're selling or we won't sell. Belief is a state of mind. Belief determines the meaning attached to a stimulus, and the meaning attached determines behavior. The oak sleeps in the acorns. Success comes to those who become success conscious. Failure comes to those who indifferently allow themselves to become failure conscious. The bird waits in the egg. Repetition of affirmations to your unconscious is the only known method of voluntary development of belief. I want to say that again because this is something that has been examined in a number of ways at a number of neuroscience labs. Repetition of affirmations is the only known method of voluntary development of belief. So visions are the seedlings of reality. If you can't see significant wealth in your imagination, in your vision, you won't see it in your bank account. Each of these is a state of mind. Belief, hope, courage, tolerance, confidence. You're not ready for something until you believe you can acquire it. Belief is a state of mind that may be induced or created by affirmation or by repeated suggestions to the unconscious mind. Repetition of affirmations to your unconscious is a powerful method of voluntary development of belief. Any thought that's repeatedly passed on to your unconscious mind is finally accepted and acted on. This is as true for wealth accumulation as it is for other consistent repetitions, such as crime. Belief determines the action of the unconscious mind. We come to believe what we repeat to ourselves, whether it's true or false. If a lie is repeated, it ultimately is experienced as the truth. The teller ultimately can't tell the difference. The mechanism, focus aligns the energy field of the brain, and repeated focus rewires the brain, so belief becomes an anatomical reality. Now, there are two types of belief. One is global beliefs, like life is, people are, or I am, you know, fill in the blank. Each affect the way we look at and interpret things and their meanings. Another set of beliefs are rules, cause and effect, if then, or if this, then that. Now, these are the questions clients will have, though they may not be specifically spoken consciously. And there are five, and these are in your outline. The client must believe that you have their best interest at heart. The client must come to know in some way, what would this product mean to me? Does it fill wants and needs and avoid pain? And if, even if that's the product is your service or the engagement in coaching, is it worth it to me? What would other people think or say, and do I really need it now? Now, the short term is usually associated more with pain. Most people need to think long-term to be successful. Remember from what we talked before, selling is a transference of emotion. You must feel certain to make someone believe. The number one way you convince someone else is if you're convinced. You will transfer whatever state of mind you're in, whether that's doubt or whether that's confidence. The second difference between success and failure, after beliefs, is state management. Here's an everyday application to recognize and understand emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain, then to the hippocampus to attach meaning, then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually, to make logical sense. Now, a footnote here, the hippocampus is the primary location of the unconscious. It's where meanings are attached. But notice, the emotional activation registers before cognitive areas of the brain ever come into a play to assess options, before we're ever conscious about it. Everything at the lower, the emotional brain, and the midbrain is an unconscious process. Neuroscientists have demonstrated, for example, that we make decisions, especially buy decisions, purchase decisions, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware. Now, once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or to a no, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision, to find something logical and sensible for it to light on, even if it's not an accurate cause and effect. This rationalization is called confirmation bias. In other words, we cherry-pick data to support what we believe or what we want, and we become blind to data that refute it. So when we make a choice, we couple memory and wisdom from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. So Consider what that means. The part of the brain that anticipates a pleasant outcome, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, activates a buy decision because the buy decision kicks in dopamine, the pleasure chemical. A don't buy decision originates in the insula. It's an area involved in anticipating pain. The pain that's anticipated is losing something that's a part of us, our money. The anticipatory emotions bias as well as drive decision-making. So think about how that works. When credit cards decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and paying, the activation of the pain center in the brain. So it's not a here and now balance of decision. the pleasure of the purchase is segmented from the pain of future payment. This segmentation renders repayment a future abstraction. So we put it off until next month. Our optimism bias even probably suggests that we'll have more money later. So this results in 23% more purchase when we use credit cards than when we use cash or check. Another application, it's hard to save because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying because that kicks in dopamine, the pleasure principle. So to substitute a future need such as saving for a later time is substituting a theory like future need or long-term saving or retirement for the immediate payoff. So, three reasons people fail. Not enough compelling reasons, limiting belief systems, and the inability to consistently manage state of mind. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. So, that means that it will be imperative for us to find ways to regulate our state of mind because it determines the meaning we attach and our behavior. So our state of mind always comes first. State always comes first, then strategy, and then story. So let's look at the two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology and focus. Physiology, how you use your body. How you use your body to change your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. Now, this is fairly easy, and the usual tools are relaxation, or deep breathing, or meditation. Focus is what and how you focus on. From quantum physics in the brain, we know this. You get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. Your state of mind determines the meaning you attach. The meaning you attach determines your behavior. So your power is what you focus on. Now, these two primary ways to regulate your state of mind, physiology and focus, the questions we ask determine what we focus on. Questions direct a focus, therefore determine the state we're in. A couple of questions we're always asking. What does this mean, and what should I do? If you have, let's say, an habitual feeling that you don't like, or you're going through a period now in your work or in your life where there's a repeated focus and questions in a negative way. Why does this always keep happening to me? The presupposition is that you're in a passive position and ineffective. Why am I overweight? The focus is on the negative, on overweight. The quality of your life comes down to the quality of the questions you ask daily. So a simple way to address this is change the questions. Ask a better question. You're always asking questions from the moment you wake up, though you may not be aware of it. If you immediately begin by asking what can go wrong today, you've already begun a scenario that establishes a state of mind before you ever get out of bed. Another bad question, can I really do this? So ask a better question. What can I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of? And have fun doing it. One thing that you might try, this is something that I did with a couple of coaching clients who were having a particularly difficult time in their companies and their businesses. Both of them had similar situations in that there were really upsetting issues that were affecting the entire company. One was an accident, another was a happening at the company. And these two executives were in a very similar situation in that they were always fending off problems, having a very difficult time of stress going through these situations, each with their different companies. What I suggested to both of them was exactly what I just told you, that we're always asking ourselves questions, even when we wake up, before we're even consciously aware of asking them. And those affect our state of mind, and that launches our day in a particular path. What I suggested to each of them was that they write down, before they went to bed, sometime in the prior day, they write down three empowering questions, questions that would put them at a peak state of mind, and to put those by their bedside table as soon as they turned on their lamp in the morning, before they even got up, before they even fully woke up, to grab those questions and answer them and get themselves launched for that day in a different state of mind by the focus of the questions that would regulate their state of mind. And they both had remarkable success with this, in that it set the tone for the next several hours, and then they built on that. So your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. So by asking questions that empower, that put you in an optimum or peak state, can be very, very important. Asking effective questions determines a state of mind. This is the power of focus. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. So I want to look then at optimum performance state of mind. The difference between a professional and an amateur, between massive success or less, is the ability to manage your state, to achieve and sustain a peak performance state. Selling is transferring emotion. Your state of mind will have emotional contagion. Manage your state because it induces a state in others. You associate positive or negative emotions and state to your service or your product. So does your prospect. If you're not in a peak state, like a down feeling or a lesser expectation, that will also be emotionally contagious. Authentic energy is contagious. When your story truly excites you and you let that excitement show, it will be infectious to the audience. Your authenticity of genuine enthusiasm and conviction will resonate with your audience. Now, a secret here. Why does someone who begins at a peak state with a client or a customer come across as hyper or like a typical salesperson and turn the prospect off and create a response like an eye roll at an over-the-top, off-the-wall spiel that turns the listener off within the first few words? The answer? They don't begin where the client is. Remember, the first feeling, the first thing we do with the client is to empathically resonate and find a way to communicate that experience. The result is to co-create a common ground, a reciprocal connection. Then the client can go someplace new with you to follow your lead. You co-create a state that is a mutual journey, a process to arrive stepwise at the same place. Remember, state always comes first, then strategy and story. Many years ago, I had a very succinct and powerful lesson about this from a very accomplished woman executive in psychoanalysis with me. I offered an interpretation to her that I thought was a particular insight. She paused. I knew something was going on. Finally, she rose up on one elbow, turned around on the analytic couch to look directly at me and said, "No, Kruger, first you have to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." A brilliant, simple synopsis of the very principle we're talking about. We have to be together with a client, then go someplace new. So consider these questions for your reflection. How much money, how many clients have you lost because you haven't been in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? How much has it cost you emotionally, such as regret or pain or less energy, of not being in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? In the next 10 years, what will it cost if you don't change? In the next 10 years, what if you operate at peak state and enjoy the process? Selling is a transference of emotion. You associate your state to your product or service. People associate your state to your product or service. People buy a state. State change is activating. It stimulates the error detection mechanism, which causes people to pay particular attention. State is what you're selling more than a product or service. Selling is influencing the client's focus, the value, the benefits, and to avoid pain. Questions control what we focus on and the state we're in. Patience is a mindset to develop thoughtfulness, depth, and wisdom. So let's talk about peak state now, to match the optimum state of mind to the specific task. First, anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. The quickest way to change your state is to change the way you're using your body to cue that state. Develop a power cue or a gesture that immediately puts you in an optimum state. For example, when you hear Lisa and the CTA greeting for teleconferences, when she recorded that message, smiles and believes, as it does, conveys that sense, that state of mind of the greeting that she does for the CTA calls when you call into CTA about anything. Remember, your optimum state for some things, such as a presentation, may be to energize yourself and generate optimism. For other things, like working with a client, it may be to get fully centered and grounded so that you have full range of your entire spectrum of information from states of mind. At times, it may be helpful to have a quick way to change a mood, to move to a mindset of confidence and peak performance. Additional ways to regulate your state of mind for a specific task, develop a mantra. Look in my blog archives at mentorpath.com at my blog for the blog on mantras. And that really is a story I won't take time to go into for this, but it's an illustration of how to instantly get into a peak state and to match the state to a particular performance. And a shorthand, the mantra of how to do that. What you may also want to think about doing is recall an instance of optimum performance, including details of that time, as well as how you felt after your accomplishment, or to set a specific goal for your performance. I will deliver a powerful and compelling talk to the group of women financial consultants. Now, it's also important to stay immersed in your state, to not judge or observe while you're doing it. Remain immersed in the flow to sustain your mindset. I want to give you an example here of a state of mind by using confidence as an illustration of a state of mind. We now know that confidence is a greater predictor and determinant of success than competence. For example, in studies with business school graduates, men initiate salary increases 40% more than women do. And when both ask, women ask for 30% less than men. At Manchester Business School in England, Professor Marilyn Davidson said, "I've been doing this for 7 years, and every year there are massive differences between the male and female responses. The male students expect to earn significantly more than the women, and when you look at what the students think they deserve to earn, again, the differences are huge. We can never earn more in the outside world than we can earn in our own minds. If we earn 10% more or less than that income thermostat, we automatically and unconsciously engage in automatic behaviors to reestablish the status quo, to move the thermostat back to the set point. We have to achieve it in our minds before we can in reality. Confidence is a state of mind. We always sell or engage in a manner consistent with our self-concept, just as we do in any other role that we play. A self-concept regulates every aspect of our lives. It's the software that drives the behavior. Confidence is a state of mind that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you do everything, for example, except clothes, your self-confidence in that area is low and needs to be addressed. Failure experiences or non-experiences lead to lower self-confidence and become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Consider this. When is the best time to make a sale? After a vacation and you're relaxed? When you've had debt or a dry spell? The best time to make a sale is right after a sale. Confidence is a state of mind. The major things that hold the client back from making a purchase: fear of making a mistake, concern of not getting value, worry of paying too much, question of not being able to use the product or service. The major thing that holds the salesperson back is the fear of rejection, that the client may say no. All successful sales are based on one factor: a relationship. People don't buy from people they don't like, and people can't sell to people they don't like. Based on a relationship. Enthusiasm accounts for more of sales closing ability than any other factor. The transfer of enthusiasm changes the state of the other person. Confidence begets enthusiasm. The key to developing an effective engagement is to know what your unique proposition is, what you do better than anyone else. You offer something that other products or services don't offer. What is it that's unique and special about your product or your service? People won't buy your product because it's as good as everybody else's. They will buy it because it is unique in some way for them. Your key job is to identify that unique advantage that sets you above everyone else and build your presentation around that. Your opening remark determines whether the prospect will listen to you. It needs to be planned word for word. In the first 10 to 12 words, people decide whether they're going to listen to you or not. Do you resonate with their need, their essential challenge? This is where you have to begin. Not about you, remember. An example from the announcement of this seminar series. Do you have significant expertise and credentials, but not enough clients? Focus on the key benefit that that person will enjoy, not on what you've done, your audience, how long you've been doing what you're doing, or your credentials. Hint at the result of the benefit in your first question. If you ask a question, people are conditioned to respond to the question before they respond to anything else. Make sure your question is focused on the benefit that you bring to their challenges. The person in sales must always maintain the initiative. You've never heard other professionals, like doctors or attorneys, say something wishy-washy like, "Well, what do you think about working together?" The professional makes a specific recommendation. So, let's move now to talk about a mastery model. Your body of work is the process of a creative mindset, a series of experiments that can be interesting, intellectually stimulating, and like solving a puzzle. So look for models. Find somebody who's doing business in an innovative and effective way to understand the key parts of their business model. Find someone who's doing what you want to do, having success at it, and learn from them, but do it in your way. It has to be your story. For example, when I wanted to offer a mastermind group to the licensed, specially certified New Life Story wellness coaches and New Money Story mentors I've trained, I read about models, signed up for a teleseminar course, and was mentored by a leading expert. Next, define the phases. Here's an example of such a definition or such a flow. Define a target market. Identify the pain, problems, or challenges of that target market. Create an initial offering of a service or product that solves that target market's problem. Test the offering with a finite number of ideal participants, perhaps initially even with a focus group. Debrief the test and determine how it could be replicated. Then develop other offerings, perhaps with partners, and test again. Develop a business plan from the lessons learned and identify your ultimate offering. Develop a following, your platform, such as your mailing list, your blog, your newsletter, LinkedIn, professional Facebook. Develop a product to sell to the market when your list grows. Continue to test, debrief, and continue building services and products. Then, what's the next thing you want to add to your body of work? What do you want to create? Name it. Describe it. For example, a teleseminar. Who's it for? Describe your audience. Why does it need to get done? Describe the roots of the project, how it fits into your body of work. Who's going to be affected by it, and what good thing will happen as the result of your completing it? How will you structure the project? Define, again, your model. And when does it need to be done? Set a deadline. Setting a deadline will crystallize backing into it and completing it by that time. So, again, focus on the basics. Give attention to every aspect of your products and services. Great work is built by great basics. Everything you do and produce needs to be totally professional. This includes even proofreading and spell checking your emails. Deconstruct everything that you do professionally, the specifics of what exactly leads to your success, the specifics of what works and what doesn't work. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. The evidence that we truly understand a pattern of behavior is when we know how to reverse it. Establish boundaries and framework for your work, including schedule, telephone, personal and professional times. Protect your energy. Create a specific creative container for your work. Treat your physical space with reverence, including everything brought into it. Respect your tools as well as your time. Use the best tools you can afford. I learned that from my dad growing up on a farm and a ranch. Cultivate your voice. Everything needs to be your story told in your voice. Keep your focus on honoring your work. Listen to criticism and accolades, but ultimately take neither personally and stay focused on your own self-regulation. Develop intuition, unique expression, ideas, all from your internal point of reference. Punch through the bag. Martial arts teachers emphasize to punch through the bag when practicing jabs and crosses. In other words, rather than focus on hitting the target, which will make them punch weak, set your target a foot behind the bag and aim to hit that. The same applies to your work, to how today's goal relates to tomorrow's goal and next year's goal, how your choice today affects those in the future, and what happens after what happens next, your goal and your stretch goal. Think like a scientist. Keep an open mind about what you're doing and whether it works or not. Evaluate all feedback from an objective perspective. Obtain a full range of feedback from all sources. 360s are useful for this too, if that's a possibility. A scientist creates a working hypothesis, tests it, observes with curiosity, asks why, tweaks, retests, observes. Let me talk about something that I think you'll find useful and very easy to visualize. And this is the circle. Imagine your audience as a person you're trying to persuade. To visualize this challenge, on a sheet of paper, simply draw a stick figure to represent this person. I'm gonna pause a minute for you to do that, to grab a paper and draw, just in the middle of the paper, a stick figure to represent the person that you want to persuade, the person you want to sell your services, say. Then, draw a big circle around the stick figure. What this does is divide the world into two parts. People who understand the world the way your audience does belongs inside the circle next to the stick figure. People who don't understand the world the way your audience does belong outside the circle. To communicate effectively with any audience, your first job is to get in the circle. The challenge with your audience is this. If your audience does not see you as belonging in that circle with them, they're not going to listen. They will not seriously consider adopting your point of view. You will remain an outsider who does not have influence. Outside the circle, no one's going to listen to you. Inside, your audience wants to know you're on the same emotional page they are. First, identify something that your audience is experiencing. Resonate with that experience. Articulate the challenge or the pain points. This moves you into their circle. Identify the kinds of emotions your audience is feeling. Then put yourself in their shoes and ask yourself why they're feeling that way. Their specific challenges. You have to resonate with, meet with your audience where you find them before they're going to walk or talk with you. See what they see, feel what they feel, and then find some part of their emotional experience that you can authentically resonate with. Now, I want to give you an example of this. A great description of how this circle technique works is a description by the Wall Street Journal of how Obama began winning presidential primaries, and people were puzzled about how he was charming voters in the heartland. Reporter Stephen Hayes followed Obama around and analyzed his circle strategy. And this is how he put it. His rhetorical gimmick is simple. When he addresses a contentious issue, Mr. Obama almost always begins his answer with a respectful nod in the direction of the view he's rejecting, a line or two that suggests he understands or perhaps even sympathizes with the concerns of a conservative. Hayes cited an example in which Obama was asked about the Second Amendment. He began his answer by saying that, having taught constitutional law for 10 years, he believed that the Second Amendment granted individuals the right to carry guns, the conservative position, and that he respected the rights of lawful gun owners to hunt and to protect their families. So, he was inside the circle. Only then, after he was in the circle, did Obama go on to talk about how he thought that there should be new laws to help trace firearms used in crimes. At the end of his answer, Obama employed one final circle move, kicking his opponent out of the circle. He said, "The argument I have with the NRA is that they believe any constraint or regulation whatsoever is something that they have to beat back. And I don't think that's how most lawful firearm owners think." So, Obama is left standing next to the lawful firearm owners, his audience inside the circle, while the NRA has just been declared bereft of common sense, not like us, and cast out of the circle. So, winning means not only getting inside, it also means pushing your opponent out. The circle vision creates, or actually suggests, that to bring an audience over to your side, your first move should be to go where your audience is. Connect with the audience, and then you can walk back in the direction you come from. So remember we talked before, what you want to do is to resonate with the challenge or the pain that the audience has. This is what gets you into the circle. And remember this. From Macbeth, we learn that we are most vulnerable not when we're beginning, not when we're destitute, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had ever experienced of winning two battles and enjoying immense popularity. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to sustain success, to continue to regulate states of mind without using substances or actions that can be destructive. Same point about the most crucial success factor is regulating states of mind, what we've been talking about for this entire seminar. I want to make one final point. I want to talk about Girl Scout cookies again. To see what else we can learn about sales, especially as it relates now to state of mind. Most Girl Scouts are taught to memorize a fairly complicated spiel, one that involves introducing themselves, talking in detail about good work that the Scouts do, finishing with how the money raised goes for great purposes. Now, this is difficult even for a professional, but for a kid talking to an adult stranger can be really scary, and it's unlikely to lead to a positive experience, for the girl at least. There's an alternative that more than doubles the sales rate, though. It's the question, instead of all this other beginning, it's the question, what's your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie? Questions focus our brains to determine a state of mind. In less than 10 words, all the nostalgic memories of cookies past are summoned up. The record holder is Proust, who took one bite of a Madeleine and tens of thousands of words later was still remembering nostalgically. In one simple question, the power and the transaction shifts with the Scout going from requesting to supplying. It's a question that avoids a no, a question that starts a conversation, a question that opens the door to emotion. Those are the questions that create value and build careers. The experience from the buyer's point of view is an emotional connection to something that's been in their life since they were a kid. There's a reason they don't change the flavor to Girl Scout cookies, as well as a positive reaction with a young person learning to speak up. Selling a state of mind far outpaces only selling Thin Mint cookies. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to talk about or elaborate further about.
Hi, Dave. This is Ron in Sydney. Can you
hear me? Hey, Ron, how are you? Great.
I'm really good, and you?
Super.
Thank you. Can you hear me clearly this week?
Very, very clearly. You're way better this week, my man. What's going on?
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Look, thank you for that for a start. I thought that was incredibly insightful, the whole ream of information. But I just wanted to go back to the beliefs aspect and so on and just ask you a quick question. How do you place the practice of hypnosis and hypnotic suggestion in relation to, for example, the case that you gave of the executives writing down the questions and so on? Isn't that almost like a bit of auto-suggestion, if you know what I mean? How do you relate those two to what you've been commenting on? I'm just interested in knowing that.
Well, that's a great question, because hypnosis is a state of heightened suggestibility because of the focus. What someone does in hypnosis is to determine a focus, and that's exactly what we know from quantum physics and the quantum Zeno effect, that when we consistently align our focus, the energy field of our brain aligns, and by doing that consistently, we begin to rewire our brain. But most immediately, a focus, as well as physiology, determines a state of mind. And in hypnosis, the focus is there, and the state regulation is there also, because without even focusing on it, that's often what someone does, is regulate their physiology and to gauge the normal breathing pattern of a subject and align with that. But the focus is the key, even though the physiology is part of the context. Does that make sense in terms of your question now?
Absolutely. I raise that because I tend to use a level of, I'm not quite sure whether you would call it deep relaxation, but I certainly would call it deep focusing techniques with clients, because I find they have dramatic effect, positive effect on the clients in much the same way as you described the questions that these guys wrote down before they went to sleep. Of course, I found the timing of that very critical, Dave, because if there's negative stuff in the unconscious at that point in time, as you so rightly pointed out, it may take a while to start eradicating that. That's been my experience. How's that fit in with your theory? Do you find that the same way, that it could take a bit of time to eradicate one, as you call it, and rewire in another sense?
Yes, it does, and I want to back up. Can you give an example about how you would use that deep focus with a client? What's a typical example? And I want to add something to that, because I think you really have emphasized something that's really important. Do you have an illustration of that?
Yes, of course. I can give you the case I was working with just pretty recently is an executive who is suffering from highly successful, but profoundly introvert, and as a result is just failing to develop a good line of connections to offer himself ongoing consulting work as he moves forward, with the result that obviously his organization struggles a bit. So my process over a period of time eventually identified just really poor self-esteem. There were a number of areas in his life, in his youth and so on, that had affected this. So what I started was, in each session, before we began the proceedings in that coaching session, I would put him into a nice relaxed state, not quite the couch state that you probably used as a psychiatrist, but I have a nice reclining chair, put his feet up, and I allow him then to go through a process of relaxing the body bit by bit until he's in a reasonable state, and then close his eyes and then start talking back to him what he has been saying to me in previous occasions about where he's struggling. So, for example, if he struggles to go into a particular director's office and have a very frank conversation, and we have worked on that, I would almost like play back to him in little sound bites, the role and the picture that he wants to be, the state that he wants to be in, and then allow him probably 3 to 5 minutes of rest to absorb that before actually then returning to the normal state and slowly getting back into a session. So that's how I use this in order to change things, Dave, because my belief is that everybody has the innate ability to do this. They just don't know how to do it. I hope that's clear enough and that it's what you were looking for.
It is. That's a great illustration. Thank you, Ron, for sharing that. And I want to just emphasize doing something very related to that, that those of you who have worked with clients who really have a particular upset when they've called. Let me just give you a couple of examples. There have been maybe in the decade that I've been doing this, I've only done it a couple of times, but have had clients who at the time that they called for their session had just had some really upsetting event or something really that what was so preoccupying, and they wanted to didn't think they could use the session in a productive way, and suggested that perhaps that we reschedule. And I requested that just for a moment or two before deciding that to see if they would like to engage in a relaxation exercise with me. And we would do that, and I would do a progressive relaxation with them for just a minute or two. And much as Ron described, once they had regulated their state of mind and gotten very centered and grounded, they were able to make even better use of the session, and at a very important time of needing to regulate a state of mind, they were introduced then in what we did and having a model of how to do that so that they could do that for themselves whenever they needed that. So it offered an opportunity not only to deal with the issue, but also to create a model of how they could self-regulate, because this is the end in mind in the beginning as we work with clients, to have them internalize the process so that they ultimately won't need us anymore. And the ultimate goal of regulating states of mind is to use this as self-reflection and self-regulation. A couple of articles in the most recent Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind both have mentioned self-reflection as essential success strategies for executives. So it's something that is increasingly being recognized now as something that has an immense value and something that we can do as coaches as we appreciate this. So great examples, Ron, and great questions. Thank you very much. Other thoughts or comments about any of what we're talking about now? I will send each of you a work page. It's not going to make sense when I it's not going to make sense when I send it to you. But we'll talk for I can explain it in just 2 or 3 minutes at the beginning of our next session. It's called a neuroconditioning work chart. Something that Ron mentioned is something that I'd like to share with you in terms of helping someone look at something negative or something that they triggers or, you know, emotional triggers or cues that create an instant state change, and ways that we can effectively help someone work with that. So I will send that to you as an attachment, and then our last seminar we will spend just a couple of minutes on that at the beginning, and I'll walk through that as a way of guiding you about how you might use that. And I think it'll make sense to you, and I think it'll be a useful tool for you. So we've got just a minute. Any other questions or comments before we wrap up today? Well, thank you all very much, and thanks for your comments and questions. I appreciate it, and I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Thanks again. Bye now.